he did was give Jackson more guns. Now there were at least 13 guns at the edge of the woods, all under his command. The fight for Henry Hill, and the hopes of the Confederacy, would pivot for the next few hours around Jackson's 1st Virginia Brigade. By about 1 p.m., the new line was in place, stretching for a quarter of a mile across the top of Henry Hill, fronted by those guns. Most of the men were on their bellies in the woods, lying flat as flounders, recalled the 4th Virginia's John Lyle, as the Federal guns continued to boom from the far hill. Jackson, presenting a large and inviting target on horseback, seemed relaxed, unworried, almost unnaturally calm. "General Jackson rides several times along where we're lying, and often goes over to the artillery," wrote one of his men. "He seems to be very quiet, so we think that all is right, and that this is like battles generally." Beauregard and Johnston went to work trying to patch together the scattered, disorganized, and demoralized Confederate brigades that sagged 400 or more yards behind Jackson's right. It was difficult work. "Every segment of line we succeeded in forming was again dissolved, while another was being formed," wrote Beauregard, who for a change was making himself useful. More than 2,000 men were each shouting some suggestion to his neighbor. Where was Union Commanding General Irvin McDowell, while the Confederates, outnumbered and threatened with destruction, were feverishly trying to patch up their lines? The answer was that he was making his first big mistake of the war. He didn't see it that way. He was, at that moment, quite pleased with his situation, which looked to him very much like imminent victory. Though his flanking scheme had started badly, he had surprised and then routed the enemy. Burnside's brigade had been bloodied, but McDowell still had the better part of 18,000 men on the hill. Before him he saw a rebel army in chaos, confusion, and retreat. Whatever force might be up there on Henry Hill, there was none that he could see, would be no match for the sort of firepower and infantry he had in place. But now, for some unknown reason, perhaps because he was momentarily stunned by his own success, or because he believed that with such an astounding advantage in men and materiel, speed was no longer of the essence, McDowell paused. For 2 full hours, no orders came from his headquarters. It was as though suddenly there was no particular plan of battle, and no one running the army, which suddenly found itself standing about, awaiting orders. McDowell's strange entr'acte had been a miraculous gift to the beleaguered Confederates, and they had used it well. But it would not last. At 2:30, the Union Army finally started moving. Like the old Napoleonic armies, it came with its field artillery out in front. Their attack began when 2 batteries, with 11 guns, crested the northwestern side of Henry Hill, a mere 300 yards from Jackson's line, unlimbered, and opened fire. In artillery terms, 300 yards is virtually point-blank range. Jackson's guns now roared to life, too, and thus began a furious, hour-long duel between Jackson, who at VMI had been one of the first to test and recommend for adoption the rifled Parrott guns now aimed at him, and the Union batteries commanded by Captains James B. Ricketts and Charles Griffin. For Jackson's men, who had already had shells lobbed at them for more than an hour by the more distant guns, it was a harrowing experience. A storm of ordnance now flew at them. Not just solid shot, but also anti-personnel projectiles such as shell, which exploded into shrapnel, and spherical case, which was hollow and loaded with smaller balls that sprayed in all directions. Tedford Barkley of the 4th Virginia Regiment described what happened to his regimental mates. William Patterson shot with a cannonball through his breast, killing him instantly. Ben Brady, struck on the right hip with a piece of bombshell, he lived for 5 or 6 minutes. Charlie Bell was killed with a piece of the same bomb, lived about 2 hours. His whole right shoulder was torn off. Jackson continued to ride up and down his line on Little Sorrel, who was as unperturbed by gunfire as he was, repeating, "Steady, men, steady, all is well." He moved, according to one admiring soldier, "in a shower of death as calmly as a farmer about his farm when the seasons are good. He seemed to be a different man in the heat of battle. His eyes blazed. His whole being seemed to glow with the ardor of the fight. One soldier in the 33rd Virginia recalled that former VMI cadets, observing the cool confidence of their commander, now saw the warrior and forgot the eccentric man. At one point, as shells exploded in fragments that embedded themselves in trees, men, and horses, Jackson, speaking with Imboden, had thrust his left hand into the air, a characteristic gesture that seemed to accompany prayer. According to Imboden, as he spoke, he jerked down his hand, and I saw that blood was streaming from it. I exclaimed, "General, you are wounded." "Only a scratch, a mere scratch," Jackson replied, and binding it hastily with a handkerchief, he galloped away along his line. Though Jackson was clearly getting the better of the Union in his artillery duel, at short range the Federals' technologically superior rifled cannons lost their advantage over the old-fashioned Confederate smoothbores, he was worried about his flanks. At 12:30 he had repulsed a brief attack on his right by a Union brigade that had come upon the field by way of the Stone Bridge. Now he split Jeb Stuart's 300 cavalry and deployed them to his right and left, looking for advancing Union columns. They did not have to wait long. A courier from Stuart told Jackson of Union infantry moving on his left, to which Jackson, his eyes lighting up, replied, "Good, good." As he had intended, the enemy had not seen his men in the woods. The Federals heard the crack of rebel muskets, and soon a sharp fight was raging on his left, between his 33rd Virginia Regiment and the two Union regiments. The Federals had initially mistaken Confederates for their own, which made this somewhat worse for them. The Virginians loosed successive volleys and drove the Federals back. As they were reeling down the hill toward the Sudley Road, Jeb Stuart and 150 horsemen, who had been itching for a fight all day, now slammed into them, driving them from the field with heavy casualties. One of Stuart's horsemen described the killing of a Union soldier, a brutal act unimaginable the day before, but already commonplace on this battlefield. "I leaned down in the saddle," he wrote, "rammed the muzzle of my carbine into the stomach of my man and pulled the trigger. I could not help feeling a little sorry for the fellow as he lifted his handsome face to mine while he tried to get his bayonet up to meet me, but he was too slow, for the carbine blew a hole as big as my arm clear through him." But the Federals weren't finished. They advanced again on the 33rd Virginia, this time with two howitzers they placed less than 200 yards from the Confederate line. Alarmed by the Federal guns that were almost on top of his soldiers, Regimental Commander Colonel A.C. Cummings ordered a volley that cut down men and horses. Then his Virginians charged across the open ground. Before anyone knew quite what had happened, the whooping rebels had seized the Union battery. It was the first Confederate victory of the day. Cheers went up as the members of the 33rd, many of them merely boys just a month or two from the plow handle and the mechanic shop, exulted. They would not be able to hold this position long. But what they had done would become, in fact, the turning point of the battle, the instant when that great and apparently irresistible blue-clad wave finally hit an immovable wall. Jackson had thus repulsed attacks on his right and left, and his artillery had been devastating against the larger rifled Union guns. And most of his men had yet to fight. They were still in the woods, invisible, flat on their bellies, impatient and a bit shell-shocked, waiting to attack. It was at about this time that Barnard Bee, who had been busy since his retreat trying to locate what remained of his brigade, finally came upon the 4th Alabama, wounded, exhausted from their morning fight, and resting in the woods 500 yards behind the storm of artillery and musket fire along Jackson's line. He did not recognize them at first. He rode up and asked, "What regiment is this?" Informed that the men were his own, he replied, "This is all of my brigade that I can find. Will you follow me back to where the fighting is going on?" The men, 100 of them, responded with a resounding yes. Now B pointed to his left, up the slope toward the pine woods on the edge of Henry Hill. "Yonder stands Jackson like a stone wall," he said. "Let's go to his assistance." At the time, his statement, overheard by four witnesses, probably sounded like an inspiring bit of metaphorical language, something to help spur the men into the fight. But B's words would become one of the most famous utterances of the war, noteworthy both because they gave birth to a name and a legend, and because they were among the last words ever spoken by the dashing warrior from South Carolina, one of the battle's greatest heroes, who at that moment had less than an hour to live. Now the battle changed. Up to this point, it had been largely an artillery duel, but the charge by Jackson's Virginians and their seizure of Griffin's guns marked the start of a more personal struggle. This time it would be infantry against infantry, regiment against regiment, man against man. It began when the 14th New York, a regiment from Brooklyn wearing red trousers and red kepis, trained a murderous fire on Cummings' 33rd Virginia, which retreated from its captured guns under fire, losing an astonishing third of its men. Suddenly, after their great success, the troops on Jackson's left were collapsing. The emboldened New Yorkers, scenting victory, now came straight on against the Confederate center, the 4th and 27th Regiments, who had been on their bellies in the woods for several hours. The usually reserved Jackson was all animation now, eyes alight, face glowing with the heat of battle, moving along his line, telling his men, "Reserve your fire until they come within 50 yards, then fire and give them the bayonet, and when you charge, yell like furies." The New Yorkers moved forward, and Jackson's men did what they were told, waiting, then opening on the enemy with a furious volley of canister and bullets. Canister consisted of tin cylinders filled with iron shot that, when fired from a cannon, created the effect of a sawed-off shotgun and was extremely destructive to human beings at up to 250 yards. The Federals were driven back, they regrouped, came on again, and were repulsed yet again by rolling volleys of canister and lead. Undeterred, and acting more like veterans than the green troops they were, they attacked a third time, many of them this time coming within a few yards of Jackson's line in a loud and savagely close fight. They paid for it. At such short range, the Virginians cut them to pieces. The Yankee battle line faltered, stood as though frozen for a moment in the swirling eddies of smoke, and then broke. Now Jackson prepared to charge. He ordered his artillery from the field to clear the way for the infantry, then rode over to the commander of the 4th Virginia Regiment, Colonel James Preston. "Order the men to stand up," he said. "We'll charge them now and drive them to Washington." Obeying their orders and screaming like whatever they conceived the Furies to be, Jackson's Virginians swept straight out of the woods toward the retreating enemy and toward those lethal Federal batteries on the far edge of Henry Hill. The peculiar, piercingly loud noise the advancing men made was something neither Rebel nor Union troops had heard before, and whose exact inspiration is unknown. It was the implausible result of each man giving a sequence of three sounds that registered somewhere between the screech of a bird and the bark of a fox. A short, high-pitched yelp, followed by a short, lower-pitched bark, followed by a long, high-pitched yelp. Collectively, the noise sounded feral, unearthly, and inhuman, like an ululation from the pit of hell. It would become the stuff of Union nightmares throughout the war. As one Federal soldier put it, "There is nothing like it on this side of the infernal region. The peculiar corkscrew sensation that it sends down your backbone can never be told." The practice would spread through the entire Confederate army, and it would soon have a name: the Rebel Yell. On came Jackson's Confederates across Henry Hill, toward Henry House and the two Federal batteries, where the remaining Union men maneuvered around dead and dying horses and fired canister that tore through the Confederate ranks. Still, Jackson's men came on, bravely crossing 300 yards of open ground with all that flying death in the air around them. There had been nothing in their lives before to prepare these young men for this, for the astounding sense of pure vulnerability of so much soft human flesh in the presence of so much buzzing lead and iron. Some were scared and expected to die. Others, like Gunner William Thomas Pogue, described a strangely calm feeling that might have been something like what Jackson himself experienced in battle. "This was a most novel sensation," he wrote later. "Hard to describe. A sort of warm, pleasing glow enveloping the chest and head with an effect something like entrancing music in a dream. But my observing, thinking, and reasoning faculties were normal." The time was about 3:30. Jackson's two regiments drove forward, piercing the enemy's center, in Beauregard's words, and capturing the Federal guns. "The charge of Jackson's men was terrific," wrote Private John Kaisler of the 33rd Virginia. "The enemy were swept before them like chaff before a whirlwind. The men seemed to have caught the dauntless spirit and determined will of their heroic commander." More Confederate troops were now on the field, having been ordered forward by Beauregard, and suddenly, as he observed, the whole of the open surface of the plateau was swept clear of Federals. But nothing was settled. As dramatic as it had been, Jackson's charge was only the beginning of a bitter fight for possession of those two Federal batteries, which would change hands at least three times as the battle surged forward and backward across the top of the hill. For whatever reason, these new troops on both sides fought fearlessly and stubbornly and went down in staggering numbers. Colonel Francis Bartow, one of the heroes of the morning, was shot dead. Barnard Bee was mortally wounded. Jackson, on a horse that was limping due to a leg wound, was holding his wounded hand aloft, his military tunic torn at the edges by several bullet holes. His five regiments were at the battle's white-hot center for the next hour and took by far the heaviest casualties of any brigade. At the end of the third successful Federal surge forward, their battle line just at that moment was gigantic in proportions, crescent-like in form, wrote one observer. It seemed that the Union boys had finally cleared the plateau and had won the battle. McDowell certainly thought so. He wired Washington to that effect. "It was supposed by us that the repulse was final," McDowell wrote later in his official report of the battle, "for the enemy was driven entirely from the hill, so far beyond it as to be not in sight, and all were certain the day was ours. The enemy was evidently disheartened and broken." He was desperately wrong. Though he did not know it, he was about to pay one final time for his earlier two-hour delay. Suddenly it was McDowell's army, which had started the day with a brutal march and was now exhausted, thirsty, and out of ranks in large numbers, that was in trouble. His midday lapse, plus the heroism and hard-nosed fighting of brigades such as Evans's, Bee's, and Jackson's, had bought Johnston and Beauregard time, and time had brought them reinforcements both from their old Bull Run line and from Johnston's arriving Army of the Shenandoah. New, fresh Virginia regiments now collided with the Federals at the Henry House, driving several surprised New York regiments off the hill. Suddenly the Union boys, who had exulted in their victory a few moments before, were in full retreat. After 2 hours of brutal fighting, the Confederates held the precious hill again. The scene was horrific. The ground was thick with dead and dying men and horses, the wreckages of wagons and cannons, and of the house where old Mrs. Henry had been killed that day by an artillery shell. But the hill was theirs. Now, with astounding speed, Federal elation gave way to despair. McDowell, understanding that Henry Hill was lost, launched a final attack from a long rise just to the west called Chin Ridge, trying yet again to turn the Confederate left flank. But as he was preparing his attack, two more fresh brigades from Johnston's army, commanded by Jubal Early and Arnold Elzey, crashed into the Federal right, surprising these troops and sending them staggering backward. Union commanders tried to rally them, but soon saw that it was hopeless. McDowell ordered them to withdraw. The retreat began in an orderly fashion. But a retreat, as it turned out, required as much skill and precision as an attack. And because these men had no experience of what it was like to retire before a victorious enemy, the retreat soon became a rout, and the rout a full-scale panic. Soldiers by the thousands now merged into an unruly, terrified, disorganized mob, several hundred yards wide and several miles long, whose single thought was to flee to the safety of Washington, D.C. They reeled across the same Bull Run fords they had crossed earlier in the day. They left behind them their provisions, overcoats, knapsacks, blankets, muskets, canteens, and cartridge boxes. There was a slightly surreal cast to this chaos. Many civilians from Washington, including socialites and politicians and people who wanted to see the rebels receive a good whipping, had ridden out with picnic baskets and blankets to see the battle. They were now subsumed into or trampled by the wild, panicked mob. Some of the onlookers tried to get the fleeing soldiers to change their minds. "We called to the soldiers," recalled one U.S. congressman, "tried to tell them there was no danger, called them to stop, implored them to stand. We called them cowards, denounced them in the most offensive terms, pulled out our heavy revolvers and threatened to shoot them, but all in vain. A cruel, crazy, mad, hopeless panic possessed them." Jackson, meanwhile, had gone to a field station to have his wounded hand dressed. The first surgeon to see it told Jackson that the finger would have to be amputated. But Jackson received a second opinion from his young medical officer, Hunter McGuire, who thought it could be saved. While McGuire was dressing the wound in a tent full of wounded men, President Jefferson Davis rode up, his face stern and deeply unhappy and pale as death. He had just arrived on the battlefield and had been told by Confederate stragglers far in the rear of the terrible Southern defeat. He had believed every word of it and was now a knot of despair, disappointment, and rage. According to McGuire, he stood up in his stirrups and cried to the crowd of soldiers, "I am President Davis. Follow me back to the field." Jackson had not heard him say this, but when McGuire told him, he stood up, took off his cap, and said loudly, omitting all honorifics, "We have whipped them. They ran like sheep. Give me 10,000 men and I will take Washington tomorrow." The magnitude of the victory soon became apparent to everyone, including Davis, who reluctantly allowed the men to wrap him in Confederate flags. Cheers ran through miles of Confederate soldiers all the way back to Longstreet's troops at Blackburn's Ford, who had missed the entire show. The men were wild with excitement. As one wrote, "It passed all bounds. It approached madness. Every man of the thousands assembled threw their caps in the air, officers and all." Some of them even believed, as they stood amid the wreckage on Henry Hill, that this was the end of the war. Part 2. The Man Within the Man. Chapter 10. Glory and Darkness. The people of the Confederacy had fully expected a splendid victory. They had been quite certain that a Southern boy could whip several times his weight in cowardly Yankees, and they had been proven right. They had believed that, faced with Confederate resolve and Confederate gumption, the Federals would turn and run like scalded dogs, and the Northern boys had given them the truly immense satisfaction of doing precisely that. The Southern press was exultant. "The breakdown of the Yankee race, their unfitness for empire," gloated the Richmond Whig, "forces dominion on the South. We are compelled to take the scepter of power." The editor of the Louisville Courier-Journal was more contemptuous still. The Northern war effort would not last much longer, he said, because the Yankees, who were dastards in fight and incapable of self-government, would inevitably fall under the control of a superior race. "A few more Bull Run thrashings will bring them under the yoke." Political leader Thomas Cobb of Georgia deemed Manassas one of the decisive battles of the world and insisted that it has secured our independence. The triumph at Manassas seemed, quite literally, to be a dream come true. Except that it really wasn't at all. Those dreams of glory had not allowed for the bloodiest day in American history, in which green troops, Federals included, fought and stood fire with an unexpected fury. They had not counted on the sheer destructive power of the weapons, and the hideous, disfiguring things they did to young men, the cruel agonies of death they inflicted. Confederates lost 400 killed and 1,600 wounded, of whom 225 would later die of their wounds. Union losses were 625 killed and mortally wounded, 950 non-mortally wounded, and more than 1,200 captured. Jackson's brigade had taken the worst losses of all, 119 killed and 442 wounded. What had taken place was, by any previous reckoning in American history, a slaughter. And in spite of the crowing in the press, the South seemed to grasp that its triumph was also a tragedy. Though crowds massed in the streets of Richmond, there were no wild celebrations, no bonfires, no cannonades, and bells were silent in the steeples until the next day, when they summoned worshipers to prayer. In Savannah, Georgia, the gatherings had a similarly melancholy cast. "Our city is filled with mingled exultation and sorrow at the news of the recent triumph," wrote one resident. "Colonel Bartow and some of our best young men have fallen, and our city is filled with mourning." Victory was also tempered by stark military reality. The exhausted, disorganized Confederate Army was in no position after the battle to pursue its quarry into Washington to deliver a final blow. In the North, reactions ranged from despair to visions of the apocalypse descending. "Today will be known as Black Monday," wrote one New Yorker. "We are utterly and disgracefully routed, beaten, whipped." Horace Greeley, editor of the New York Tribune and one of the biggest boosters of an early invasion of the South, could scarcely conceal his gloom. "On every brow sits sullen, scorching, black despair," he wrote to Lincoln in a suddenly defeatist mood. "If it is best for the country and for mankind that we make peace with the rebels and on their own terms, do not shrink even from that." The disaster had seemed worse because of the fatuous overconfidence that preceded it. McDowell had been convinced at noon that he had the battle won, and he believed it again at about 3:30, when his men had seemingly cleared Henry Hill of Confederates. Back in Washington, Winfield Scott had spoken buoyantly of success and had gone to church at 11. When Lincoln, in mid-afternoon, received a wire saying that the Union seemed to be losing, he went to see Scott and found him asleep. Roused, Scott explained to the president that the fog of battle was often misleading and that he shouldn't worry. When the picture brightened, with wires from McDowell's headquarters saying he had driven the enemy before him, Lincoln went for a ride. At 6 p.m., an ashen William Seward finally delivered the news. "The battle is lost," he said. "The telegraph says that McDowell is in full retreat and calls on General Scott to save the capital." Presumably, Scott was fully awake by that time. Northern newspapers had been brimful of that same arrogance and presumption, often and bizarrely sticking with it into the following days. On July 22, readers of the New York Times were presented with a breathless and, in retrospect, comically inaccurate story of the Union victory. "After a battle of unparalleled severity," read the editorial, solemn and gloating, "in which our soldiers fought against great odds, they have come off more than conquerors, not only driving the enemy from their formidable positions, but seizing all their guns and equipments. The glorious flag that flew at Sumter is now fully avenged." What had taken place was not just a victory, according to the Times. It was also a total devastation of the Southern Army. One can only wonder how many Northern hearts leaped when they read it. But the North's agonies of despair were not really what they seemed, either. The first lesson of Bull Run was that, bad as it was not the foretold Armageddon. There was no final settling of accounts. The Union Army was battered and demoralized, but it still existed. And until the moment panic seized them, most of its soldiers had fought hard and well. Northern advantages in wealth, population, and industrial capacity were all just as they were. Washington was safe, and it soon became clear that the battle's ultimate effect would be to strengthen Northern resolve, not weaken it, as the initial shock and distress shifted quickly into a grim new determination. The day after the battle, President Lincoln signed a bill for the enlistment of 500,000 three-year volunteers, and 3 days later signed another for 500,000 more. The public response in the North was immediate and enthusiastic. New recruits jammed Union recruiting offices. Even more important, for the future of the war, Lincoln had found someone to lead these new men. At 2 a.m. on the morning after the battle, he sent a telegram to the dynamic 34-year-old Major General George Brinton McClellan, fresh from his victories in Western Virginia, ordering him to take command of the new volunteers, who would soon be gathered into an entity called the Army of the Potomac. McClellan happened to be Jackson's classmate at West Point, and his opposite in almost every conceivable way. He was coming to Washington, as he and many other people in the North saw it, as the savior of the Union. For the South, the unquestioned Confederate heroes of the Battle of Manassas were Pierre G.T. Beauregard and Joseph E. Johnston, in that order. Beauregard, hero of Sumter, got most of the credit. He really deserved very little of it. It is true that once he had figured out that his great advance on Centerville was not going to take place, and once he had understood at length what young Porter Alexander had instantly realized from seeing the flash of a distant gun barrel, he moved expeditiously to the scene of the battle. And it is true that he did a reasonably good job of helping establish the Confederate line around Jackson's Virginia regiments, playing the role of dime store general, riding up and down the lines, exhorting the men, leading a charge here and there, and generally offering a good example to green troops. But he had very little tactical effect on the battle itself. None of that seemed to matter, for now the main story, and the one the press was running with, was that he had stayed at the front in the heat of battle and rallied the troops and had ordered charges at the right time. As the hero of the war's first engagement at Fort Sumter, enormous expectations had been loaded onto him, and he had, almost miraculously, lived up to them. No one knew anything yet of his astounding errors of command that morning, or of the wildly impractical, if not outright crazy, battle plans he had proposed in the preceding week. No one suspected that his victory rested substantially on the shoulders of subordinates acting without orders. Those annoying facts would surface soon enough. For the moment, he was again the confirmed hero of the South. Joe Johnston, meanwhile, actually deserved some of the laurels he received. He had gracefully agreed to retire to the rear, behind the lines and away from the fight, but from there exercised a large and telling influence on what eventually happened, calling up regiments and brigades, organizing them, and hustling them to the front. It was those replacements, inserted into Henry Hill and Chinn Ridge, that had finally made the difference. The other great public heroes of the battle were the martyred Barnard Bee and Francis Bartow. That week their bodies lay in state in Richmond with an honor guard, while lines of mourners filed by. Then there was Jackson. Though he had contributed as much or more to the Southern victory as Bee, Bartow, Evans, Hampton, or Early, and arguably had done more than either Beauregard or Johnston, recognition in the general public of what he had done came slowly. This was not due to neglect by his commanding officers. Johnston had forthrightly praised his high, soldierly qualities and his admirable conduct, and given him large credit for reestablishing order on Henry Hill. Beauregard, in his official report, lauded the astuteness of the defensive position Jackson had chosen, praised his brigade's charge across the plateau, and said, "The conduct of General Jackson also requires mention as eminently that of an able, fearless soldier and sagacious commander, one fit to lead his efficient brigade. His prompt, timely arrival before the plateau of Henry House, and his judicious disposition of his troops, contributed much to the success of the day." This was solid, if not rapturous, praise, and took its place in Beauregard's lengthy report detailing much praiseworthy officer conduct. Still, such a commendation tended to stay where it was, inside the official army reports of the battle. Jackson, meanwhile, ever modest and self-effacing in public, had experienced the battle from its blazing center, and knew precisely what he and his brigade had done. In a letter to his old friend Jonathan Bennett, he wrote, "That my brigade passed our retreating forces, met the thus far victorious enemy, held him in check until reinforcements arrived, and finally pierced his center, and thus gave a fatal blow," and compared them to Napoleon's Imperial Guard. God gets credit, as usual, but pride, ambition, and a desire for recognition permeate his words, up to and including the exaggerated idea that his men delivered the fatal blow. They did not. This tension, describing his personal achievement in a desperate fight, while simultaneously denying that he had anything to do with it, persists in a letter Jackson wrote to his wife Anna the day after the battle. "My precious pet, yesterday we fought a great battle and gained a great victory, for which all the glory is due to God alone. Although under a heavy fire for several continuous hours, I received only one wound, the breaking of the longest finger of my left hand. My horse was wounded but not killed. Your coat got an ugly wound near the hip, but my servant, who is very handy, has so far repaired it that it doesn't show very much. The battle was the hardest I have ever been in, but not near so hot in its fire. I commanded in the center more particularly, though one of my regiments extended to the right for some distance. There were other commanders on my right and left. Whilst great credit is due to other parts of our gallant army, God made my brigade more instrumental than any other in repulsing the main attack. This is for your information only. Say nothing about it. Let others speak praise, not myself." The problem was there were no others, just at that time, speaking any praise. Almost all commendations in Southern newspapers went to Beauregard, Bee, Bartow, and various South Carolina, Alabama, and Louisiana regiments. The Richmond papers, enormously influential in molding Southern opinion since their articles were reprinted everywhere, did not mention Jackson's role in the battle for an entire week. And then it was to report that he had had his finger blown off, untrue, and a horse shot from under him, untrue, but had remained cool as a cucumber. So complete was the silence that by the first week in August, Anna was upset over what appeared to be the total neglect of her husband's accomplishment. On August 5, Jackson, who was transparently sensitive to all this, wrote to calm her down. "And so you think the papers ought to say more about your husband? My brigade is not a brigade of newspaper correspondents. It is not to be expected that I should receive the credit that Generals Beauregard and Johnston would, because I was under them. But I'm thankful to my ever-kind Heavenly Father that he makes me content to await his own good time and pleasure for commendation." Meaning, presumably, that he fully expected that commendation to come. Unbeknownst to Jackson or Anna, however, his fame, or the first intimation of his fame, was already quietly spreading throughout the South. Within 3 days of the battle, the story of Bee exhorting his troops was already being told privately in Richmond among relatives and friends of soldiers. Confederate diarist Mary Chestnut, a bellwether of sentiment in Richmond and a private clearinghouse of information, wrote in her entry of July 24 that her husband took the orders to Colonel Jackson, whose regiment stood so stock still under fire that they were called a stone wall. This suggested that the story, too, was making its way through the army, where in many quarters there was already a clear sense of what Jackson and his men had done. Then, on July 25, the Charleston Mercury, another highly influential wartime newspaper from South Carolina, published its version of the Bee-Jackson exchange, rendering it as follows. "He rode up to General Jackson and said, 'General, they are beating us back.' The reply was, 'Sir, we'll give them the bayonet.' General Bee immediately rallied the remnant of his brigade, and his last words to them were, 'There is Jackson standing like a stone wall. Let us determine to die here, and we will conquer. Follow me.' His men obeyed the call, and at the head of his column, the very moment when the battle was turning in our favor, he fell, mortally wounded. Though the sequence of events was completely wrong, as was the case in all early accounts and most later histories, Bee's warning to Jackson that he was being driven was uttered at least 3 hours before his Stonewall comment. No one knew that or cared to know it, because the moment, as presented, was so perfectly dramatic. The star of the story, of course, was Bee, the hometown hero, the man who had stood against the federal hordes on Matthews Hill. But it had the side effect of placing Jackson's name in an equally heroic context before large numbers of newspaper readers in the South. On July 29, the Richmond Dispatch published the story. On August 15, the Lexington Gazette in Jackson's hometown ran it. With these notices, public curiosity about Jackson started to grow. It is noteworthy that as the nickname began to attach itself to him, it also attached itself to his brigade. Soon enough, Thomas J. Jackson would be Stonewall to everyone in the South, and eventually the North as well. But his 5 Virginia regiments that had fought so bravely and been so badly bloodied got the name too. For the rest of the war and into the annals of American history, they would be called the Stonewall Brigade, the most famous fighting unit of the Confederacy. Jackson gave a rare explanation of his performance under fire to John Imboden, who had asked him, in frank astonishment, "How is it that you can keep so cool and appear so utterly insensible to danger in such a storm of shell and bullets as rained about you when your hand was hit?" Jackson gazed at the young officer of artillery and replied, "Captain, my religious belief teaches me to feel as safe in battle as in bed. God has fixed the time for my death. I do not concern myself about that, but to be always ready, no matter when it may overtake me. That is the way all men should live, and then all would be equally brave." As the story of Jackson's exploits on Henry Hill seeped forth into a nation that had never heard of him before, there were others in both the United and the Confederate States who very definitely had heard of him. These were men who had fought in the war with Mexico 14 years earlier, most of whom were still alive and now fighting for one side or the other in the new war. The Mexican-American War was, at bottom, a political land grab on an enormous scale. As Ulysses S. Grant phrased it in his memoirs, it was one of the most unjust wars ever waged by a stronger against a weaker nation. Yet from a soldier's point of view, it was a sort of glorious aberration, a grand adventure to conquer a foreign land that had resulted in a series of military victories, some of them spectacular, all of them exotic and without precedent. There was nothing in the regular army to compare it to. No service in the Indian Wars could possibly match the romance and grandeur of it, and none of the men who marched triumphantly into Mexico City or Monterrey, among the drawn sabers and fluttering regimental flags and bands playing Yankee Doodle, ever forgot those moments. In the face of overwhelming numbers, they had conquered a nation. The Mexican-American War had produced many heroes, most prominent among them Zachary Taylor, who would soon become president, and Winfield Scott, who would soon run for president. But it also featured, among its lesser lights, a slim, soft-spoken subaltern from Western Virginia, who had done something so extraordinary that his fellow soldiers and officers would not soon forget that, either. The U.S. Congress had declared war on Mexico on July 22, 1846. What followed was essentially a war of territorial expansion, though the nominal reason for it was the 1845 U.S. annexation of Texas, which Mexico still considered one of its northern provinces. Americans wanted to keep Texas, and, under the expansionist banner of Manifest Destiny, also had designs on Mexico's other territories in the West, including California. Jackson had graduated from the U.S. Military Academy at West Point on June 30, just in time for the war. He was 22 years old and ranked a respectable 17th out of 59 cadets in his class. He had received his marching orders in July, then traveled to Mexico with an artillery company in the late summer and early fall, an arduous, country-girding journey mostly by riverboat. In late November 1846, he arrived in the northern city of Monterrey, having just missed its conquest by the dashing General Zachary Taylor. Jackson found to his disappointment that there was little to do there. But he soon received new orders to join General Winfield Scott's 10,000-man expedition by sea to the coastal city of Veracruz, where he would launch an invasion aimed at Mexico City, 260 miles inland. It was an extraordinary operation, not least for the cast of officers who were present, many of whom would later gain fame in the Civil War. They included the following future generals: Ulysses S. Grant, Robert E. Lee, James Longstreet, George McClellan, Ambrose Burnside, Pierre G.T. Beauregard, Joseph Johnston, Braxton Bragg, George Meade, Joseph Hooker, Fitz John Porter, Albert Sidney Johnston, D.H. Hill, and John Pope. Jackson had been thrilled by the prospect of combat. On the way to Veracruz, he met a friendly, if somewhat sharp-tongued young lieutenant named Daniel Harvey Hill, who had already seen fighting at Monterey. Jackson had been recommended to Hill by a mutual friend, George Taylor, who had told Hill that Jackson will make his mark in this war. "I taught him at West Point. He came there badly prepared but was rising all the time, and if the course had been 4 years longer, he would have been graduated at the head of his class. He never gave up on anything." The two young men were introduced. They had been 4 years apart at West Point. And Hill was surprised to meet, instead of a rising star who seemed destined for greatness, a very reserved and reticent young man. In spite of his shyness, he was desperate to know what Hill's battle experiences had been like. As the two walked along the beach, Jackson asked him questions about commanding troops under fire. "I really envy you men who have been in action," the youthful Jackson told him. "We who have just arrived look upon you as veterans. I should like to be in one battle." Hill later recalled that when Jackson spoke those words, his face lighted up, and his eyes sparkled as he spoke, and the shy, hesitating manner gave way to the frank enthusiasm of the soldier. Harvey Hill was destined to loom large in Jackson's life, as the man who got him his job at VMI, as his brother-in-law, and as a hard-fighting Confederate general who fought with Jackson in many battles. Jackson, who commanded a unit of artillery, saw his first action during the U.S. Army's siege of Veracruz. He performed exceptionally well under fire. One of his West Point classmates even observed that Old Jack was as calm in the midst of a hurricane of bullets as though he were on dress parade at West Point. He was cited for gallant and meritorious conduct and received the promotion to Brevet First Lieutenant, by no means a routine upgrade. He marched west with the Army in April 1847 and played a minor role in the American victory at the Battle of Cerro Gordo and arrived near Mexico City in mid-August, now assigned to one of the four light artillery companies under the command of the flamboyant and theatrical Captain John Bankhead Magruder. Magruder was a strange fellow. He was a drinker, a braggart, and a social climber. He was also a mean-tempered and often harsh disciplinarian, who, for his own personal advancement, exposed his men to extreme danger. For this reason, young officers did not like to serve under him. According to one observer, he despised Jackson, who was in most ways his opposite, and in any case was not from an FFV, First Family of Virginia, and so not worth Magruder's time. But for Jackson, this was an unrivaled opportunity, and he had eagerly applied for the transfer. He wanted to be where the battle was hottest, and Magruder's presence as a commander virtually guaranteed that. Jackson got his wish. At the Battle of Contreras, some 10 miles south of Mexico City, he found himself in a 3-hour duel against vastly superior Mexican artillery. In spite of the heavy enemy fire, Jackson refused to back down. "He stayed there without a thought of withdrawing," recalled a fellow soldier. "He'd been ordered there, and his conception of duty as a lieutenant required him to stay. His men were falling all around him, and he too, with the last, would have fallen." When the other section commander in his battery fell, mortally wounded, Jackson advanced into the smoke and confusion and continued to fire his guns. The Americans won the battle, but it was a hard fight, and Jackson had distinguished himself again. Whatever Magruder may have thought of him initially, he now dispensed high praise, saying that Jackson's conduct was conspicuous throughout the day. General David Twiggs included Jackson on a short list of officers distinguished for their coolness and determination whilst under fire. Jackson was beginning to stand out. His bravery under fire at Contreras, he was one of those soldiers who seemed completely at ease with death flying all around them, won him both a regular promotion to first lieutenant and a brevet promotion to captain. When asked later how he had reacted to being in a full-scale battle for the first time, he replied in a rare moment of immodesty that he had only been afraid that the fire would not be hot enough for me to distinguish myself. Though he later cited his faith in God as the reason not to fear death on the battlefield, at this point in his life, he was not yet a deeply religious man. Long before he placed his life in the hands of God, even a casual observer could see that the young man wasn't afraid of bullets or cannon fire. Still, he was not immune to the horrors of war, which he was fast learning. He wrote to his sister Laura, "I have, since my entry into this land, seen sights that would melt the heart of the most inhuman of beings, my friends dying around me, and my brave soldiers breathing their last on the bloody fields of battle, deprived of every human comfort. And even now I can hardly open my eyes after entering a hospital, the atmosphere of which is generally so vitiated as to make the healthy sick. To die on the battlefield is relief compared to the death in a contaminated hospital." Jackson had fought well at Veracruz and Contreras, but those battles were not what Mexican-American war veterans remembered him for. What they would recall in later years was what he did in the final decisive fight for Mexico City. As Winfield Scott's army moved ponderously forward, the last obstacle to the country's capital was a large castle atop a 200-foot hill southeast of the city known as Chapultepec. As the army advanced, Jackson's artillery unit, which consisted of 2 6-pounder cannons and was attached to an infantry regiment, found itself on a narrow causeway beneath the castle's battlements, engulfed by enemy fire. Jackson later described his situation as being fully exposed in a road which was swept with grape and canister, and at the same time thousands of muskets from the castle itself pouring down like hail. The Americans were trapped there, unable either to retreat or advance. Jackson faced 8 Mexican cannons with his 2, at very short range. He immediately lost all 12 of his horses, which went down in bloody heaps and lay there wounded or dying in harness. Undeterred, he and his small squad unlimbered, rolled the guns forward, and started shooting back. One of the guns was hit and became immovable. The artillerymen, meanwhile, facing what seemed to be certain death, fled to the safety of a nearby ditch and bushes. But Jackson refused to leave the road. Pacing back and forth alone while shells filled the air around him, including a cannonball that rocketed between his legs, he yelled to his men, "There is no danger. See, I am not hit." He said later this was the first and only lie he ever told. At first he got no takers. Then, finally, an old sergeant walked up and together they dragged the remaining cannon across a ditch and up onto the road. They began firing again. As they did so, another member of the gun crew made his way forward. Instead of accepting his help, Jackson shouted, "Go back yonder. Tell Colonel Truesdale to send men forward. Tell him with 50 men we can overrun the battery ahead." Jackson and his sergeant now stood with a single gun on the road amid a storm of ball, solid shot, shell canister, and musket fire so severe that no one else dared raise his head above the roadside ditch. His own crew had abandoned him. The entire infantry regiment to which he had been attached had disappeared, except for a small escort. What Division Commander General William J. Worth saw, when he finally rode up close enough to see what was going on, was young Jackson, now in advance of the entire American army, still aiming and firing his cannon, in a virtual, single-handed duel with a significant part of the Mexican army. When Worth ordered Jackson to retire, Jackson refused to obey the order, saying that it was more hazardous to retreat than to stay put. Magruder now arrived at the perilous scene. He immediately had his horse shot out from under him as he reached Jackson's six-pounder, then dragged himself up and pitched in with a few others from the gun crews to salvage the second gun. Soon Jackson had both guns working again, plying sponge and handspike, and firing furiously at the Mexicans. And now things began to change. A brigade that General Worth had brought up began to make itself felt, pushing forward. On the hill above them, the defenses of Chapultepec Castle began to crumble, and the long American lines began to surge forward and upward. Chapultepec soon fell. But Jackson's work was not finished. A few miles down the road at the gates of Mexico City, Mexican General Santa Anna rallied his remaining troops. General Scott ordered another attack. Jackson, still eager to fight, quickly found wagon limbers to which he could attach his two guns, and started out at a fast pace toward the city's San Cosme Gate. He was moving so fast, in fact, that he soon found himself well in advance of the rest of the army. In that precarious position, a mile ahead of Scott's infantry, he encountered two other young officers who had made the same mistake, his new friend Harvey Hill, and another lieutenant from South Carolina named Barnard B., a man Jackson knew from West Point a year ahead of him, and who had been brevetted for gallantry at Cerro Gordo. Hill and B. had about 40 men between them, but no guns, and were talking about going back when Jackson, dragging his two guns behind ammunition caissons, rolled up and cheerfully volunteered to give them artillery cover. The three of them were discussing this when Magruder arrived and ordered them to stand down. They pleaded with him to relent. He did, and the little group took off down the road in pursuit of Mexicans. Half a mile down the road, they came upon some 1,500 Mexican cavalry, who turned and charged at them down the narrow causeway, offering Jackson a tantalizing target. He opened fire, ripping huge, bloody holes in the column. "Whenever they got a little too far," Jackson said later, "we limbered up and pursued at full gallop until the bullets of their rear guns began to fall near the leaders. Then we would unlimber and pour it into them, then limber up and pursue. We kept this up for about half a mile." Thus did Jackson find himself again in the position of fighting a very large force with a very small one. By nightfall, the shooting had ceased. The city was not yet overrun and had not surrendered. The following morning, Jackson had his guns on high ground, trained on the San Cosme Gate. Residents had been warned that if they did not surrender by a certain hour, the shelling would start again. When Mexican authorities ignored this, Jackson received an order to open fire on the main thoroughfare, filled with panicked civilians. He did so immediately. He later said that he could trace the visible line of death his guns had made. When asked, many years later, if he had any compunctions about killing those people, he answered, "None whatever. What business had I with results? My duty was to obey orders." Later that day, Winfield Scott marched into the city in triumph, the last dramatic piece of a brilliant, bloody campaign. News of Jackson's exploits, meanwhile, moved quickly through the army. There was no doubt at all about what he had done. It had been witnessed, not only by his immediate superior, but also by a division commander. And there was no question that the actions of this brave brevet captain had affected the course of the battle. He was singled out for lavish praise from Generals Worth and Pillow, and his name was even mentioned in the commanding general's report, an extreme rarity for a subaltern in charge of two field artillery pieces. But the highest praise came from Scott himself. After the army had occupied Mexico City, Scott hosted a reception for army officers to which Jackson was invited. He waited in the receiving line, heard his name read out, and finally came into the presence of the massive 300-pound commander. Scott regarded him, clasped his hands behind his back, raised his chin in the air, and said in a booming voice so that everyone could hear, "I don't know if I will shake hands with Mr. Jackson." Jackson blushed to the tips of his whiskers and stared at the floor of the now silent hall. Scott now continued, "If you can forgive yourself for the way in which you slaughtered those poor Mexicans with your guns, I am not sure that I can." With that, Scott held out his hand and smiled as the crowd applauded. Jackson shook it. He was thrilled. He could have received no higher form of praise. He had been on active duty for only 15 months, and he had been promoted to first lieutenant and then to brevet major. No one in his class from West Point, indeed no one in the entire army in Mexico, had been promoted faster. He was 23 years old, and in the small, tightly circumscribed world of the U.S. Army, he was famous. Chapter 11. A very small, very bitter fight. In the summer of 1861, as citizens in the North and South tried to sort out what had happened on Henry Hill and Chin Ridge, they began to discuss a new topic, their generals. A few months before, no one had cared particularly about generals, who they were, what they looked like, or what they might have done in the Mexican-American War, or in some dusty Indian outpost in the West. But all that had changed. Suddenly the world was awash in these folks, with their sashes, side whiskers, and idiosyncrasies. And because the fate of the country and the lives of thousands of young men rested in their hands, they were the objects of keen, often obsessive interest. They were the new celebrities. Names of formerly obscure regular army types, such as David Hunter and Joe Johnston, now populated the pages of the newspapers and soldiers' letters home. And the more often they appeared, the more the names began to take on emblematic status. Beauregard was the dashing spirit of Southern victory. McDowell, the symbol of unsettling, inexplicable Union defeat. B represented the notion of tragic glory, of the sacrifices that would have to be made. McClellan, remote and magnificent in Ohio and Western Virginia, was the hope of the despondent North. Jackson was not yet among those prominent names. To the extent that anyone knew him at all, he embodied the nickname Barnard B. had given him. He was steadfast and immovable, an iron-hard fighter who would stand on the soil of Virginia, eyes ablaze and chin tilted toward the heavens, and defy the Yankee invaders. If this seemed two-dimensional, the man his soldiers saw was scarcely more defined. Their experience of him was strictly military, all protocol and logistics and army business. He did not make small talk, he rarely socialized, and he revealed little of himself to subordinates. He was usually polite, but the soft-spoken politeness itself, like his regular daily prayers, offered alone in his quarters, was a form of aloofness. Brigadier General Jackson seemed, indeed, like a wall. It was impossible to penetrate him. But Jackson was, in a larger sense, anything but opaque. After the Mexican-American War, he had spent 5 years in the regular army, in postings that included Pennsylvania, New York, and Florida, long enough to be well known to his peers and commanders. For a full decade, from 1851 to 1861, he had lived a very visible life in Lexington, a small college town of 2,000 souls where everybody knew everybody else's business. He was deeply involved in the very small and very transparent world of VMI, where he was one of a handful of professors. He was a deacon at his church. He had married twice, owned a red brick house in town and a modest farm outside of town, sat on the board of a local bank, and was active in the local debating society. He had several close friends. To them, and to many others in Lexington, Jackson was considerably more than this implacable, God-obsessed mystery whom people were starting to talk about. He was just Major Jackson, a shy and socially awkward man who was perhaps not a very good teacher, but who had nonetheless built for himself a tidy, middle-class life. A very American story of hard work and self-betterment and modest success. That story begins in 1851, not in Lexington, but in the months just before he arrived there, in a swampy backwater in Florida, where young brevet major Thomas Jackson had finished his regular army career by doing something truly extraordinary. He had single-handedly transformed a small, sleepy garrison into a nightmare of recrimination, political infighting, and moral accusation. Jackson's return from the Mexican campaign was inevitably less than glorious. After a brief posting to a barracks in Carlisle, Pennsylvania, he landed at Fort Hamilton, on the coast of Long Island, about 10 miles from New York City. Compared with the swashbuckling and high adventure of Mexico, this new life was commonplace. It gave him his first real taste of the often dreary, routinized life of the peacetime army, where promotion was slow, action rare, and political backbiting the order of the day. Though he was quartermaster and commissary of his unit, he spent much of his time on court-martial duty, traveling to upstate New York and Pennsylvania to sit on military juries, ruling on desertions and insubordination and drunkenness and other army sins. On the brighter side, the new life offered him free time. He attended an Episcopal church where he was baptized, read the Bible, and began what would become a full-blown obsession with his health and diet, eating stale bread and plain meat to ease his chronically upset stomach, taking water cures, and doing leaping and swinging exercises that caused much curiosity at the fort. There he passed his 25th and 26th birthdays. In December 1850, he was reassigned to Company K of the 1st Artillery, and to a post that would soon make Fort Hamilton seem like a dream of happiness. This was Fort Meade, Florida, a 3-day march to nowhere, through swamp and pine forest from Tampa, itself a forlorn outpost of 200 souls in the flat, humid, lake-pocked terrain of central Florida. The entire state of Florida had only 85,000 inhabitants, half of them slaves. Fort Meade's ostensible purpose was to protect white people from marauding bands of Seminoles, more specifically those Seminoles who had not accepted the treaties under which they would be forced onto Indian territories in what is now Oklahoma. That there were hardly any of these Indians out there did not seem to matter. There had been much blood shed and money spent fighting them since 1817, and forts had been built, and they all had to be staffed with armed men. Company K consisted of a commanding officer, 52 enlisted men, and 4 officers. They were the only human beings, as far as anyone knew, within 10 miles of the fort. Jackson arrived there with the rest of the company on December 18, 1850. His posting started well enough. His job was again quartermaster and commissary, in charge of property, supplies, and food. His commanding officer was a portly, balding Baltimorean with a protuberant mustache named William H. French, who had graduated from West Point 9 years ahead of him. The two men had known each other for 3 years, and if they weren't exactly friends, they seemed to have been pleasant enough acquaintances. French invited Jackson to dinner several times in his first months there, where Jackson enjoyed the company of his wife, the lively Carolyn Reed French. Like Jackson, French was a stickler for duty and detail, and like Jackson, he had won brevet promotions for valor in the Mexican-American War, and though he held the actual rank of captain, Jackson was a first lieutenant one notch down, they were both brevet majors. They resembled each other in less benign ways, too. Neither had an engaging personality, and both were ambitious for promotion and advancement. Unlike Jackson, French could be rude and abrasive. He was also more than just a perfectionist, he was a meddler as well. He insisted on involving himself with the smallest details of barracks life, and often found fault with those details. He wanted a formal report, for example, on why a musket belonging to one of the enlisted men had been damaged. When Jackson, presiding over a case of drunkenness and unsoldierly conduct, found the corporal guilty and recommended punishment, French rejected it as too lenient. Jackson came in for criticism in other ways, too. French dispatched him twice to find Indians. On both occasions, after marching long distances through jungles and swamps, Jackson failed to do so. French was furious and fired off a note to Army headquarters accompanying the report of Jackson's second expedition with a vow to go myself and endeavor to turn the southern and eastern point of the lake rather than throw it on my subaltern should Indians be on the other side at this season, which is corn planting time. Jackson chafed under all this. He was unhappy. His health declined, notably his eyes, which were most likely afflicted by a condition known today as uveitis, an inflammation of the iris and pupil that causes eye aches, bloodshot eyes, sensitivity to light, blurred vision, and floaters. He may have suffered from dyspepsia as well. In February, he tried and failed to transfer to another post. Relations between the two men continued to deteriorate. As company quartermaster, it was Jackson's responsibility to supervise the construction of several buildings at the fort. He considered this an important part of his job. Now French began to assert control over the process, overriding Jackson's orders and making his own changes. Jackson's unhappiness soon gave way to anger. Whenever he encountered French at the fort, Jackson averted his eyes, an old military practice known as cutting. French did the same, though in Jackson's case the behavior bordered on insubordination. They spoke to each other only about official matters and only when necessary. Finally, Jackson could take it no longer. He wrote a formal protest to the commanding officer in Tampa, saying that French was interfering with his rights as a quartermaster. French, angered by Jackson's righteous nitpicking, blasted back in his own note to Tampa. Jackson, in fact, was way out of bounds. He was, in effect, asserting that he was entitled to an independent command within a company of 52 men and 4 officers occupying a small fort. He was insisting that he should not be subject to the normal command structures of the Army. 6 days later, he received a categorical rebuke from Colonel Thomas Childs in Tampa, who stated pointedly that the general commanding knows no state of military affairs where the commanding officer can divide responsibility with a junior. He also lectured Jackson. A difference of opinion amongst officers may honestly occur on points of duty. It ought never to degenerate into personalities or be considered a just cause for withholding the common courtesies of life so essential in an officer and to the happiness and quiet of garrison life. Still, Jackson was not finished with French. This dispute had been about rank and authority. The next one, which exploded over 2 weeks in mid-April, was about morality. It began with gossip, specifically a scandalous story about Captain French that made the rounds of the garrison in early April. The 35-year-old French lived at the fort with his wife, 2 small children, and a household servant named Julia. In the account Jackson heard, French had been seen walking alone with Julia in late afternoon and early evening on several occasions, both on the post and in the woods. The suggestion, delivered with a wink and a nudge, was that French and Julia were lovers. Jackson had also heard that several of Julia's potential beaux among the enlisted men had understood that they were supposed to stay away from her because Captain French had taken her for himself. In a small, remote garrison, such a rumor would have spread quickly. And it might have remained a rumor had Jackson not decided to intervene. His reaction to the gossip was in some ways predictable. Adultery was a crime, both in the military and in civil society. It was also a sin against the laws of God, prohibited by the 6th commandment. So Jackson decided, without authorization, to conduct his own investigation. An extraordinary and risky move by a young first lieutenant against his commanding officer. If Jackson was fearless, he was also shockingly insensitive to what his action inevitably looked like. The opportunistic and even malevolent work of a disgruntled subaltern engaged in a highly visible power struggle with his commanding officer. On April 12, unbeknownst to French, Jackson summoned and interrogated a dozen enlisted men in his office. He promised the interviewees that nothing would happen to them, then proceeded to ask them detailed questions about what they had seen. Where had French and Julia been observed walking together? At what hour? Had anyone seen or heard of any immoral conduct? Had one of them witnessed, through an open window, the two of them together on the captain's bed? Jackson's questions could be quite specific, too. When one enlisted man denied having seen the two on a bed together and said he had only seen a foot in the room, Jackson wanted to know if the legs were bare or covered or belong to a man or a woman. Thus it went, the young first lieutenant grilling the reluctant, deeply uncomfortable men. As a criminal investigation, it was a notable failure. A few of the men had seen French walking with the girl. That was all. Sensing the peril of their position, the men immediately told their sergeant what had happened, and the sergeant, sensing the peril,